So we're going to talk now about colorectal cancer. I'm really excited for this session as well. Actually, as the faculty is coming up here, I just want to kind of recount as you're sitting down here an experience I had a couple weeks ago in colon cancer. We had this sort of thing. I was kind of getting interested in the idea of a paper of the year. So I decided to ask ChatGPT what they thought the paper of the year was in general. And we were doing a program on a colorectal cancer at the time. And it actually brought up a couple of colon papers, the Breakwater study that we'll maybe talk a little bit about, BRAF positive. But it didn't even mention what I consider the paper of the year in colon cancer that we're not going to talk about, but I want to just start out asking you about it. So first of all, let me just introduce the faculty here. I forgot to do that, but anyhow. So we have Dr. Kristen Siomber from the Vanderbilt Ingram Cancer Center in Nashville, Tennessee, and Dr. John Strickler from Duke University. And I think we have Dr. Chotsky as a co-moderator, but maybe we can find her. But anyhow, so the paper I wanted to ask you about is, to me, my paper of the year in oncology, which is New England Journal paper. I found a lot of people didn't hear about adjuvant exercise.
Yes.
Oh.
So, Kristen, you know, 3 hours of exercise, as we were saying in the webinar, if this was a drug, we'd be using it. It actually reduced the recurrence rate. Any thought about that, and what, any implications you want to comment on?
Yeah, absolutely. So the challenge data really was practice-changing for this patient population. And there are some nuances that make it a little bit harder to implement. It wasn't just doing exercise, but actually the patients who benefited were the ones who had trainers, and you know, it was quite intense. We're actually going to see some more data at ASCO, which I think will be very intriguing.
So, Mamta, welcome. I was mentioning that there was this wild paper in the New England Journal a lot of people didn't see of adjuvant exercise training, where they saw reduction in recurrence. John, any thoughts about mechanism of why exercise would reduce recurrence rate?
You know, we don't have a clear idea of what's exactly happening, but clearly there are things that we're not measuring with exercise that are of benefit to a patient, both short-term and long-term. I think that the interesting thing is, just as you said, it's structured exercise, right? So it's not just that the person is, you know, walking, you know, told, given a pamphlet and told to go walk more. There is a social component to that exercise that I think should also be part of the overall intervention and considered.
That's interesting. So, Mamta, I'm kind of curious, do you recommend exercise to your patients in the adjuvant setting for colon cancer?
This is new for me that the data is coming out, but in general, yes, in my practice, we definitely have like some evidence in breast cancer patients that the yoga and aerobic exercise have helped. So in general, I do encourage my patients to participate in any kind of yoga or aerobic exercise or walking or like that.
Mm-hmm. I think the amount of exercise wasn't that much. I think it was like 3 or 4 hours a week total. And it wasn't like, you know, that. I mean, it was semi-intense. But as you mentioned, a lot of it was with the trainer. Anyhow, my other paper of the year was something that Kristen is going to talk about. I love we've been talking about it all the time, neoadjuvant therapy. The paper came out on dostarlimab for Memorial. Mm-hmm. Not only rectal cancer, but a bunch of other cancers that we'll talk about. To me, super exciting. So why don't we start out and talk a little bit about IOs in colorectal cancer, Kristen.
Yeah, thanks, Neil. So here are my disclosures. So as Neil was just mentioning, so there was a big phase 2 study of non-operative management in patients with stage 1 through 3 mismatch repair deficient tumors. So not just colorectal cancer, though those were the majority of patients enrolled. And again, this was done at MSK and a couple of other sites, including here in Florida. One of the cohorts included rectal cancer. So this was kind of an expansion on the data we saw at ASCO 2022, looking at neoadjuvant dostarlimab for 6 months. And then if you you achieved a clinical complete response could go on to non-operative management. And in fact, all of those 49 patients did. In the other cohort, that was really the non-rectal solid tumor. So that was a slew of different tumor types, though the majority here were colon, just because of the incidence of mismatch repair deficiency. And of course, in the non-rectal solid tumors, not as many achieved a clinical complete response, and many did have to go on to surgery. But here are the rates of clinical complete response. This was, again, after 6 months of dostarlimab monotherapy. All of the rectal cancer patients did achieve a clinical complete response, but not all had a sustained clinical complete response at 12 months. One of them did go on to surgery. The rest actually went back on immunotherapy and have not had recurrence yet. So that is really encouraging data. I think reinforces our practice that patients with certainly locally advanced rectal cancer should be getting neoadjuvant immunotherapy, particularly if they're, obviously if they're eligible for that. And then in the colon section, which I've also highlighted, 82% of patients achieved a clinical complete response. So certainly less than in rectal. But you'll see that a couple of the patients who went on to surgery did have a path CR. So speaking to that discordance radiographically and pathologically that we sometimes see. This is the swimmer plot looking at all of the patients. So again, more than just colorectal, but showing the response and durability of response over time and clinical complete response rate by tumor type. In terms of what I thought was interesting, which I found in the paper, was that the median time to response for radiographically was 6 months. But the median time to first negative biopsy or ctDNA clearance was a month and a half. So of the patients who achieved a clinical complete response, they were responding really rapidly. Tolerability, I didn't include that here, but tolerability was pretty high too. The adverse events, most of them were grade 1 and 2, as you might expect, with very low rates of grade 3 and 4 adverse events. And here are the ctDNA data. So a couple of interesting things that I took away from this figure. Number one, almost all patients did have ctDNA at baseline. So we always kind of worry, particularly with these maybe small biopsies, a diagnosis, whether you will actually see, especially in a tumor-informed way, as John will talk about in a little bit. We like the tumor-informed assays, but we always worry that we won't have enough tissue to get this baseline ctDNA, but almost all the patients did in this study. And then of the patients who had a clinical complete response, they, as I mentioned earlier, they really cleared this rapidly. So maybe speaking to, a potential biomarker of response in addition to radiographic and endoscopic assessment. So there are a few studies that we're eagerly awaiting that will kind of help round out this field. There have been a lot of studies in neoadjuvant immunotherapy in both colon and rectal cancer. And this is one of them. So AZURE-1, we should see data this year. But this is the registrational phase 2 study of dostarlimab neoadjuvantly in the rectal, locally advanced rectal cancer population. So larger study than we've previously seen, 150 patients. All get dostarlimab for 6 months, and then if they achieve a clinical complete response, can go on to non-operative management. So primary endpoint here is CCR by central review at 12 months. The next study, which is still ongoing, is AZURE-2. This is a phase 3 in colon cancer, MSI-high colon cancer, looking at perioperative dostarlimab. So patients are randomized in a 2-to-1 fashion to dostarlimab, both neoadjuvantly and adjuvantly, with surgery in the middle, compared to what used to be considered our standard of care, which is surgery and then adjuvant chemotherapy. Now, as far as I know, they have not amended the protocol to allow immunotherapy, so I suspect that the rest of this enrollment is going to be ex-US, because as I'll talk about in a minute, this is no longer our standard of care. And finally, AZURE-4 is looking in colon cancer, but you'll notice that this is not MSI high, this is microsatellite stable. So in this study, which is about 150 patients, I believe, patients are randomized 3-to-1 to CAPOX dostarlimab versus CAPOX alone. Because of some intriguing data we've seen in the microsatellite stable setting, in which potentially earlier treatment or neoadjuvant treatment might see a signal. So I think this will be an interesting trial to watch.
So before we go on, John, just kind of curious, a couple of weeks ago we were in Puerto Rico for the SGO meeting. Of course, endometrial cancer, you see MSI high disease. We were talking about this strategy. There's actually an ongoing study, one of the faculties involved with in endometrial cancer, looking at the same strategies. But is the responsiveness of MSI high tumors greater with rectal cancer than other cancers? And what when you don't see response to MSI high, what's going on?
Yeah, so this is a bit of a surprise to see that great of a degree of a kind of discordant result between colon and rectal. We don't think, at least from our metastatic setting, we haven't seen such a difference. So that's not explained by this data. So we don't have an answer in that respect. In terms of for those patients who are not responding to immune therapy, who have an MSI high tumor, what's going on there? Well, there's a couple of explanations. One explanation is, you know, not all MSI high is MSI high. It's a gradient of microsatellite instability. And some of these non-responders may be in this more intermediate range. Maybe their tumor mutational burden is as high. So phenotypically, they're kind of in that in-between zone, and perhaps that could explain some resistance. And then there are also some innate types of MSI high disease as well that have some built-in alterations that may prevent T cells from engaging the tumors, though those have been described in the literature as well. But there's probably many explanations for why a tumor might be resistant to immune therapy, not just one.
We'll see too with as this larger study comes out what the data looks like. Kristen, any situations where you might want to use upfront immunotherapy with colon cancer, MSI high, older patient in bad condition, maybe really advanced a local tumor?
Yeah, so interestingly, just a month or two ago, the NCCN guidelines did update to say that for, it used to be that unresectable or bulky T4B tumors could receive neoadjuvant immunotherapy. Now it's all, it's an option for all resectable and unresectable non-obstructing tumors. So that actually expands the population quite a bit in terms of who is eligible from a payer perspective. But yes, we're having that conversation more and more, not just in the elderly or patients who want to avoid
really?
Surgery.
Have you done it?
Yes, we're doing it more and more.
Wow, interesting. Mm-hmm. So Mamta, any thoughts? You know, one of the issues we were talking about is the issue of obviously biomarkers is a huge issue in oncology in general, particularly colorectal cancers. Any questions you have in terms of, you know, the workup of these patients?
So many times being as a community oncologist, we don't get to see the patients till the surgery is done. So many times we don't get this opportunity even to consider or doing even the biomarkers testing to see if patient is MSI high, maybe we can do immunotherapy. So that's a challenge that we face it in our practice, but it's great if we have these options. I mean, we can save a lot of patients not doing the chemotherapy, and especially being in Florida, we have like many geriatric patients, and 85, 90s, 94, that's our kind of average patient's age population we see it.
Another huge, gigantic paper.
Yes, absolutely. This is definitely practice changing. So this is the ATOMIC study that was presented at the plenary last ASCO. And this was looking at the addition of atezolizumab, a PD-L1 inhibitor, to standard adjuvant FOLFOX in the resected pathologically staged stage 3 MSI high colon cancer. So this was a big study. It took a long time to complete, and basically randomized patients to FOLFOX plus or minus atezolizumab. You'll notice that the FOLFOX was 6 months and atezolizumab was a year, and I think that will come to be very important, but the primary endpoint here, disease-free survival. So one of the important things here is that pathologically, these were fairly locally advanced patients. So T4 is about a third of the patients, and same thing with N2 disease. So sometimes we will see radiographically that we clinically overstage MSI high tumors, but this was the real deal in terms of really stage 3 tumors. And I think that's an important thing when we compare some of the non-operative management or neoadjuvant immunotherapy trials in which patients are clinically staged. But one thing that kind of bothers me about this study is just the amount of therapy that patients get here. So oxaliplatin, I've highlighted the median number of cycles was 10, which makes sense given that 6 months of FOLFOX was planned. But really from the IDEA sub-analyses, you know, many of us are no longer doing that much oxaliplatin because it really does cause a lot of irreversible neuropathy. Patients also got bolus 5-FU, which many of us are not doing anymore, and just in lieu of just the continuous infusion. We can talk more about that. And then atezolizumab was about a year of therapy with, you know, even though it's fairly well tolerated, you know, significant chance for toxicity over time. But the primary endpoint of disease-free survival was better in the atezolizumab-containing arm, and this increased by about 10%. So more patients are being cured with the addition of atezolizumab, and that's really important. So again, pathologically stage 3, so these patients who go to upfront surgery, have stage 3 MSI-high tumors, are eligible for this therapy, should be receiving atezolizumab-containing therapy. We always wonder, okay, what if there had just been immunotherapy alone adjuvantly? Of course, that's the question we want answered. These are the data that we have. Disease-free survival benefit really crossed all subgroups, which was important to see, even the low and the high-risk patients. And what you might expect, the grade 3 and 4 treatment-related toxicities with the combination is about 70%. So in comparison, and this is maybe an unfair comparison, but the neoadjuvant immunotherapy trials, many of those, the grade 3 and 4 adverse event rate is about 5 to 10%. So, of course, chemotherapy is adding a lot to this, which is not insignificant for our patients. In general, the safety profile was kind of as expected. No new real safety signals with the addition of atezolizumab. So as a result, this is also on the NCCN guidelines for patients with surgically resected stage 3 MSI-high colon cancer.
So, John, any thoughts about skipping chemo?
Yeah, so there's a few things we've learned over the years. In fairness, this ATOMIC study was designed well over a decade ago. And at the time, it was considered very forward-thinking. Now, in 2026, we consider it to be not really the study we want, right? So we've learned a few things since this study was designed. The first is that MSI-high disease is chemotherapy-resistant disease. That's been shown out of CheckMate 8-HW. So we're looking to avoid cytotoxic chemotherapy for these patients. We've also learned that immune therapy appears to be more active when you have an in situ malignancy, not after it's surgically removed. So you'd rather have a neoadjuvant strategy, not an adjuvant strategy. And then finally, our patients don't want FOLFOX. This is a lifetime of neuropathy, potentially, that impacts the patient's quality of life, sometimes for decades. Many of these patients are young. So we look at my institution at the NICHE 2 data, which you showed, which is a neoadjuvant approach where you give just two doses of Nivo, one dose of Ipi, and 111 patients treated, not a single recurrence at 3 years with MSI-high disease, with not a drop of chemo.
Of course, that mirrors what we see in metastatic disease.
Exactly. And then we see this, which, you know, granted, this is a prospective study. We know all the patients had stage 3 disease, but we look at this data and we talk to our surgeons and we say, look, we have to check MSI in our patients before they go to the operating room, because if that patient has MSI-high disease and they have a high risk of having stage 3 disease, we'd rather just give those two doses of Nivo, one dose of Ipi, and no chemo at all, as opposed to sending the patient straight to surgery, and then that patient's looking at 6 months of FOLFOX with atezo. Additionally, we at our institution withdrew from the study because we were uncomfortable with the way the FOLFOX was administered in this study. So this is the standard of care. It's in our national guidelines, but I don't think, if I knew a patient had stage 3 disease, it's MSI-high, I would not follow this approach. I would take a neoadjuvant immune therapy approach.
Any questions from you, Mamta? Have you had any patients with MSI-high localized colorectal cancer?
Yes. So We have many, treated, but the one that I can share is my 94-year-old. She had two synchronous tumors. One was ulcerated 11-centimeter mass in the left colon and about 2.6-centimeter in the transverse colon. Turns out to be both T2 and 0. MSI high, tumor mutation burden like 63. So she underwent for the surgery. I saw the patient after the surgery, by the way. Mm-hmm. And we chose to give her Pembro immunotherapy. She had treatment. She was 94 then. Now she's 96 and still doing well.
Yeah. any issues with the Pembro?
She tolerated it extremely well.
So, and I'm curious too whether or not, Kristen, would use this other than stage three. Mm. I've got several cases, including one that Dr. Kumar, he's my great question asker and case presenter here in the first row. He actually emailed me here about this 6-year-old woman, stage two, T4, N0, M0, status post R0 resection, MSI high, by IHC of a negative germline, BRAF mutated, interestingly enough. Some post-op woundy has since, but not infected. ctDNA negative. Should this patient be treated with? Kristen, and a couple other cases from the audience of T4N0, will you go lower?
Yeah, this is the really hard part, and these patients were not included in ATOMIC, right? It was only stage three, as I've highlighted. So we're not sure. We always think T4 is really higher risk. In the MSI-high setting, particularly with post-op issues, other things, I don't know that I would treat. It sort of depends on some of the other, whether any other high-risk features are present, but particularly ctDNA negative, having post-op healing issues, I might just watch this patient.
And then if she turns ctDNA positive?
Well, I don't treat on the basis of ctDNA positivity alone in terms of recurrence. I do look for radiographic recurrence, but it certainly heightens my concern.
Second opinion?
So this is one of these cases where you sit down and have a very in-depth conversation with the patient. There are cases of spontaneous clearance of ctDNA. We'll talk about ctDNA in a moment. So you would hate to over-treat a patient. But if you believe it's real, the odds of that patient having recurrent disease is exceptionally high. And the question then is, what's the standard of care for an MSI-high patient? Well, that patient has stage 4 disease, mm-hmm. if they're positive and it's a true positive. So then the question is, do we start immune therapy now or do we start immune therapy later? I would not give chemotherapy to this patient. So the question really is one of immune therapy, which one you give. Is it Ipi-Nivo? Is it single agent Pembro? And when would you start it?
All right, well, let's move on and get into one of the more interesting findings over the last couple of years from my point of view. Kristen, we've been looking for a long time, MSS disease. I remember there was a Nevo regorafenib at a while we were excited about, and mm-hmm. That didn't seem to pan out, but the zanzalintinib seems to be a different story. Let's take a look at it.
Yeah, so moving to microsatellite stable disease, so we've been trying for a long time to see how we can get immunotherapy working in this situation. To kind of set the stage for a study we'll talk about, zanzalintinib, or Zanza, is a TKI, multi-target TKI, that targets really a lot of things. So the TAM kinases, VEGFR2, MET, AXL, etc. And I've highlighted on the bottom sort of what our other TKIs in the refractory colon space target. So these are different agents. But what's interesting about Zanza is that there is some mechanism of that can kind of be used with immunotherapy to try to potentially help immunotherapy work better. So whether that's increasing the number of T cells, decreasing number of regulatory T cells, blocking PD-L1 expression, etc. So the study that was done really combined zanzalintinib plus atezolizumab, the same PD-L1 inhibitor we were talking about before. And when you think about it, in the baseline tumor environment, you have these targets of Zanza, which are VEGFR2, MET, AXL, et cetera, and they really cause tumor proliferation. And then you have this immunosuppressive environment by the activation of these targets. So if you think about it, the Zanza can actually inhibit those and potentially allow the PD-L1 inhibitor to come in and activate T cell activity. So I think preclinically makes sense that this might be a decent combination. So that led to some early clinical studies, and then finally the STELLAR 303 phase 3, which was for patients. It's a large study, almost 1,000 patients, and everyone had had prior 5-FU oxaliplatin or irinotecan. Most had had an anti-VEGF antibody, and then anti-EGFR if they were RAS wild type, and BRAF inhibitor if they were BRAF mutant. And this was a global study, and patients were randomized to Zanza-Atezo versus regorafenib, which many of us think that may be an unfair comparator because it's not really the current standard of care. Many of us don't use regorafenib because we have other options now. But that's how the study was designed, with a dual primary endpoint of overall survival in the intent-to-treat population and also overall survival in patients with liver metastases or without liver metastases, because we always think that immunotherapy potentially works less well in patients with liver mets due to the immunosuppressive environment. The baseline characteristics in the intent-to-treat population were pretty balanced across both arms, and you'll notice that about 60%, 55 to 60% of each arm did have liver metastases, which is we see a lot of patients with liver mets in our practices. And one of the dual primary endpoints, overall survival in the intent-to-treat population, did show an overall survival benefit, 10.9 versus 9.4 months for median overall survival with a hazard ratio of 0.8. And then the data for the other primary endpoint is not yet mature, but is showing currently a trend in overall survival favoring the combination. Now, we don't know, the contribution of components here. Would this be different if we had Zanza alone? Regorafenib as the comparator is challenging. So there are a lot of potential questions here. The FDA is considering this for FDA approval, and we should know that by December. Overall survival subgroup analyses were pretty favorable, consistent across all subgroups, including the liver met arm, and of the patients who got prior anti-VEGF did look better for the combination. PFS in the intent-to-treat population was statistically significantly better, though only about 1.7 months with a hazard ratio of 0.68. And just like our other kind of third line and beyond therapies at the current time, we don't see a lot of RECIST evaluable responses. So most of this, of the patients who are benefiting, are really having stable disease here, with about 4% of patients with an objective response in the combination arm and a disease control rate of 54% compared to 41% in the rego arm. There are some more toxicities with Zanza-Atezo. So diarrhea is the big thing, though most of those were relatively low grade. You do see some more higher grade hypertension than even with regorafenib, and then but not as much PPE as you see with regorafenib. So something certainly to consider. And then we're awaiting the results of the FDA's decision about whether this will be a new approved regimen. But in the meantime, there's another study coming called STELLAR 316, which is really looking at Zanza plus or minus Atezo in patients with MRD-positive localized colorectal cancer. So these are patients who have surgery, get adjuvant therapy, are positive by ctDNA, and we're always like, well, what do we do now? These patients have a very poor prognosis, as John said. So that's where this study comes in, to see if disease-free survival can be improved by treating in that MRD-positive space, and I'm sure we'll hear more about that from John as well.
So really provocative data there, Kristen. I mean, one question, you said that you don't use Rego. What do you use?
Yeah, so in the third line, I typically use trifluridine, tipiracil, and Bev. And then usually in the fourth line for fruquintinib, though sometimes I will flip-flop those if patients have a lot of cytopenias, because the trifluridine, tipiracil can worsen that.
So, of course, I want to know whether the two of you are interested in actually using this strategy. Kristen, is this something you want to use? And I guess another thing is, any hints? It looks like maybe there's a tail on the curve.
Yeah.
Always with IOs, you're always thinking about that.
Yeah.
We always talk about the extensive stage small cell. Well, median survival's 13 months, but there are 15% of people still alive or not alive in the control arm in five years. What are you thinking? Would you like to be able to do this?
Yeah. I think these data are a little underwhelming, to be honest, and I would be curious to see what John thinks. But, you know, the benefit seems pretty slight. I mean, but it is a positive phase three trial. Our patients will definitely want immunotherapy. So I think we have to be really judicious and evaluate the data and make sure that this makes sense.
So John,
if it is approved.
I not only want to know whether you want to use it, I want to know whether you, if it were approved or whether or not you would discuss it with the patient. If the patient wanted to do it, even if you didn't want, would you do it?
Yeah, I mean, so let's talk about the data and how that influences our decision-making. So it was a positive trial, technically. It's a 1.5-month survival benefit. The PFS is almost doubled, so that's obviously positive in favor of the combination. I think where you get some concern is the magnitude of benefit is small and the toxicity is greater. Now, there's two reasons why the toxicity could be greater. The first is because the combination is just more toxic. The other is because the patients were on twice as long, right? So they have more time to collect these adverse events. But when I look at that data, I do worry that the dose for the zanzalintinib in particular might be too high, especially for a real-world patient. I will, if I were to have access to this regimen, I've personally never given it before, I would be thinking very strongly about a lower dose, for especially for the zanzalintinib. I worry that that dose of zanzalintinib is too high. But I would talk to the patients about the data. That clearly having access to an immunotherapy for an MSS patient is intriguing. We have this general consensus that immune therapy might have activity among patients with non-liver metastatic disease, and this could give a patient access to immunotherapy in that setting. Though I'll note in this particular study, we didn't see an outsized contribution from the non-liver met group. Mm-hmm. So all this is to say is I probably will use this combination selectively, but also carefully based on the toxicity data.
So, Mamta, I'm kind of curious how you think this is going to sit in your practice. I'm curious, too, whether or not patients are bringing in AI, you know, ChatGPT data. And we used to talk about pulling things from the internet, and I'm curious whether people are bringing in AI suggestions. And how do you think this kind of conversation is going to go if you have this opportunity?
So that question comes up many times, not just for the colon cancer, but in general for any other cancers. Every patient always wants to go for IO. They never want to say yes for the chemotherapy. So that's in general, like, they think it's the best and obviously well-tolerated, so that comes up all the time. But then obviously we have to go by the data and evidence-based medicine and then direct to the right choice.
All right, so we're going to move on now and talk about other advances, particularly cell-free DNA. This is the number one question we get in when we do webinars. We have like a RTP pool about how long it's going to be. No matter what the tumor type is, where somebody brings up the issue of cell-free DNA, and everybody references back to colon cancer. So, John, let's talk about it.
Well, in fact, I had so many slides on this that I couldn't get to the other half of the topics on the cover.
We cut him in half. He still had too many slides.
Yeah. So that just
here to talk, dude. You know?
Yeah. All right. So here are my disclosures. So I think there's a few questions that come up, and I'll just break it down to very real-world questions for us in the clinic. The first, what's the mechanistic rationale for this ctDNA-based MRD monitoring? And you know, when you think about circulating tumor DNA, it is pervasive now across all these different questions we have in the clinic, from early detection now and interception all the way up to molecular profiling and looking at acquired resistance. But what I'm going to focus on is this question around where that patient has no measurable disease on imaging. Can we use ctDNA to kind of augment our surveillance and understanding of where that patient sits in their disease continuum? And in fact, depending on that patient's baseline risk of recurrence, the question is somewhat different. So where a patient comes in with maybe a low risk of recurrence after surgery with curative intent, then the question is, can we de-escalate treatment, take it down a notch? And then for those patients who have an exceptionally high baseline risk after surgery with curative intent, is there an opportunity to be more intense, to escalate our treatment to give that patient a better outcome? So we really need to be thinking about that baseline risk as we incorporate MRD testing into our practice. And there, we've got a couple of tools that we can use now in the clinic that are commercially available to us. One is the so-called tumor-informed class, where you have that patient's tumor surgically removed, run a whole exome or whole genome assay, and create a custom panel of variants just for that patient, and then draw blood over time looking for molecular variants that match up to that tumor that we thought was removed. And in fact, we have a number of different real-world validation studies done across the world. The largest of all of them was the GALAXY study in Japan, several thousand patients, all stages of colon and rectal cancer. Blood was drawn before surgery, then after surgery, then every 3 months to 2 years. And these curves really drive home the point that this is a very powerfully prognostic biomarker. For disease-free survival, this is one blood draw after surgery, using the Signatera tumor-informed assay, 12-fold greater risk of recurrence if you're positive after surgery as opposed to negative, and we also see a prognostic impact on survival. Then the question is, okay, if I have a positive result and the scans are negative, how long is it going to take me to find a tumor? And in their data set, it was 5.9 months. Here in the United States, we have very similar results out of MD Anderson Intercept. I think it was closer to 5 months. But that's a general look at how long it will take to find that cancer. But this is not a static environment. We're now seeing new assays come in the clinic that are increasing the number of variants. So the so-called whole genome sequencing assay uses a far number greater of variants to increase that sensitivity level. And in this very preliminary data, once again out of Japan, showed that all the recurrences were detected with a single postoperative time point, even down to less than 100 parts per million. So it's an extremely sensitive assay. Now, the question that comes up is, as you raise that sensitivity, do you potentially introduce false positives? Does your specificity go down? And that's something we're going to have to answer in more real-world validation data sets. Here, the specificity was listed as 86%. We also have tumor-naive assays. No tumor tissue required. You take the kit out, draw the blood, send it off to the company. And that typically relies on methylation patterns. In addition, sometimes they'll incorporate circulating tumor DNA as well. Now, there have been some real-world validations of these, a little less robust validation, but this is the COSMOS CRC01 trial, once again out of Japan, where they found a 6-fold greater risk of recurrence using this tumor-naive assay immediately at that postoperative time point. Now, you'll notice I used 12 before for tumor-informed and 6-fold greater risk of recurrence for this tumor-naive. There's a general sense that perhaps these tumor-naive assays are slightly less sensitive, but that's never been validated in a head-to-head comparison. So looking at the menu of options we have in the clinic now, when a patient comes in and says they want an MRD test, we have to decide as clinicians, do we want a tumor-informed assay, which requires tumor tissue, or do we want a tumor-naive assay where you just take that kit and send it right off, with those caveats that I just mentioned? And then if you choose a tumor-informed assay, you have to decide, do I want to go with the tried-and-true whole exome assays, which are more heavily validated, or these next-generation whole genome assays, which have sometimes up to nearly 2,000 different variants as opposed to the 16 variants off of that first-generation whole exome assay. So all of these things we have to decide in the clinic. And so what would I would say about the mechanistic rationale? I mean, the classic rationale is to find this cancer before the scan does. We've got two categories of tests, tumor-informed, tumor-naive, and if you've got tumor-informed, you've got to decide between a whole exome or a whole genome. And there are trade-offs in terms of sensitivity and specificity, but that hasn't been truly validated yet because we don't have head-to-head comparisons.
So just to interrupt you, and we'll stop the timer just so you know.
Yeah.
Friday night we did a program on lymphoma, and we had Jill Sal from Memorial there, and he had a slide that said Signatera on it. I'm like, and then afterwards I talked to him. And I said, are you doing Signatera? And he said, don't you guys, like I always think of Heme, they have their own sort of MRD assays. He said, no, we don't have anything in diffuse large B cell, and they actually are using So is there any reason you can't use it in hematologic cancers?
So all you need to run a tumor-informed assay is a piece of tumor tissue where you run a whole exome or whole genome assay and collect variants that you're convinced are just part of that tumor and not part of the patient, right? And then you create a custom panel, and it does not, this is not a colon cancer panel. This is for any tumor of any type.
No, I mean, I think diffuse large B cells is a perfect example, curative disease. I mean, you would want to see. So anyhow, I thought that was I wasn't aware of that.
So now we're in this question of what's the actual evidence we have for using these in the clinic? And in some ways, the real world has passed far beyond the NCCN Guidelines Committee, which is a bit more conservative. She's laughing. She's on it. Yeah. And I ask her about it, and she says, do you want to be on that committee? Yeah. So,
We don't do guidelines. We just ask people what they do.
Yeah, exactly.
If they all do the same thing, it's a consensus.
So what's the actual evidence for this, and why is it still a somewhat controversial topic? Well, there has been observational data sets now that have been out for years that indicate that you could potentially use this data to guide adjuvant chemotherapy decision-making for a patient with resected colon or rectal cancer. This is, once again, that Galaxy data set out of Japan, which used the Signatera tumor-informed assay. You'll notice on the left, these are the patients who are MRD positive after surgery. And you see adjuvant chemo appears to have a benefit here for those patients who are MRD positive. But on the right, these are high-risk stage 2-3 patients that are MRD negative. There's no difference between the curves. These patients do the same whether they get chemo or not. Now, this is observational data. It's not prospectively validated. And I think that's the concern here. Would you act on this? And we have data both in favor of and against acting on this data. So in this next slide is the dynamic study, which was presented at ASCO 2022, published in New England Journal. This was an Australian group that used a tumor-informed assay. They took patients with stage 2 colon cancer, resected with curative intent, then randomized these patients to standard management, where basically the patients got chemo if the clinician felt it was warranted, or ctDNA-guided management, where the patient only got chemo if the test was positive. Primary endpoint was recurrence-free survival. And now we have long-term results from this study. 5-year recurrence-free survival identical, overall survival identical, and the key thing to know here is patients were half as likely to get chemo in the tumor-informed, that ctDNA group. So less likely to get chemo, but identical long-term outcomes. So for us, we, at least in our institution, we consider this to be practice-changing, and we're routinely incorporating MRD testing, particularly for our T3N0 patients, our lower-risk stage 2s, where we can potentially de-escalate treatment. But we have some data that speaks against MRD testing, and this is Dynamic 3 from the exact same group in Australia. This takes patients with stage 3 colon cancer, all of whom had an R0 resection, and while the patient was in that post-operative recovery period, clinicians nominated a chemotherapy. So classically for a stage 3, you'd give FOLFOX, right? And at the same time, they got a tumor-informed MRD assay. And then patients were randomized between standard management, which would have been standard FOLFOX, or ctDNA-informed management, where you use a negative result to de-escalate that treatment and use a positive to escalate the treatment. Let's start first with the escalation question. For those patients who are positive, classically they would have gotten FOLFOX. They got escalated to FOLFOXIRI. And how did that compare to standard management? Well, the problem here is that the red line is standard management. The blue line is ctDNA-informed. And the ctDNA-informed escalation did a little bit worse numerically. A bit of a conundrum for us. Why would the FOLFOX group do numerically better than the FOLFOXIRI? We can't explain it, but this says to us we can't use this result to escalate treatment and expect a different result. At the same time, the de-escalation data came out a few months later. This was published in December of last year as well. Here, if patients were going to get FOLFOX, they got de-escalated to maybe just 5-FU, and they were compared against standard management, which would have been FOLFOX. And we can see here for a low risk, no real strong detriment to de-escalation, but on the clinical high risk, really bad idea to de-escalate treatment off of a negative result. we see numerically patients are doing much better with standard management as opposed to a lighter regimen. So we know we can't, at least in the stage 3 group, de-escalate treatment based on this result. So it's not all bad news in 2025 for MRD management. I found this data to be very interesting and provocative. We can debate whether it's practice-changing or not. This is CALGB 80702, which was actually published a number of years ago. It was a 2x2 design comparing 3 versus 6 months of FOLFOX, but then they also had a celecoxib versus placebo comparison as well. Enrolled 2,500 patients. Now, the overall study showed that there was no benefit for adjuvant celecoxib, but the investigators went back and collected the blood and tissue, and they had it for 1,000 patients. 20% were positive after surgery, 80% were negative, and then they looked at the impact of celecoxib versus placebo, and here's the top-line results. You can see here, among the ctDNA negatives after surgery, no benefit for celecoxib, but among the ctDNA positives, there's a 40% risk reduction in the chance of recurrence with that celecoxib, but only in the positives, not in the negatives, and this held up for survival as well. They then went back and looked at PI3 kinase status. You had wonderful speakers. I enjoyed watching the breast cancer oncologists talk about PI3 kinase pathway. Well, it also looks to be relevant here for colon cancer. They looked at the impact of PI3 kinase pathway alterations, and it didn't matter. Celecoxib was equally active, whether that patient had a PIK3CA wild type or a mutant tumor. So what is the evidence that we have now? I think we know MRD status is prognostic. I think it has utility for T3N0 stage 2s. We don't have evidence we can escalate or de-escalate treatment based on a positive or negative result in stage 3. And I do think there's an argument to be made that you could give celecoxib or even the non-selective COX inhibitor aspirin for a patient that's MRD positive with stage 3 disease. We've got a lot of validation to do. This is Circulate US. This is still going on recruiting. Looking at it, using that tumor-informed assay to guide escalation or de-escalation decisions. And then I am blown away by the number of studies for MRD-positive disease that are ongoing in the United States right now. There's so many, I had to group them by class. This is immunotherapy strategies for MRD-positive disease. Some of them have very clever names. Targeted therapy and chemotherapy trials as well. I'm really interested in this bottom one, precision MRD, which looks at early use of targeted therapeutics for these patients with MRD-positive disease. So that's what I have.
All right, let's get real practical here. Kristen, you have a patient with stage 3 disease. Maybe there's T2N1. They're not excited at all about getting adjuvant chemo. Would you offer them the opportunity to get a ctDNA analysis to inform their decision?
Yeah, well, I do offer MRD testing to my patients, and I have a pretty nuanced discussion with them because I've actually had patients decline the option because, I will often tell them, listen, if it comes back positive after we finish adjuvant chemotherapy, we don't know what to do. We may scan you more often, but, and some people say, you know what, that's going to make me too anxious if I'm in that situation. So I think it's really important to have those conversations. I am not at the point with stage 3 disease where a negative ctDNA test post-op will tell me that that I can avoid chemotherapy. But there is that 20% who are positive, who I follow very closely with adjuvant chemotherapy, because if they don't clear by the end of adjuvant chemotherapy, then, that's a really bad sign.
But. All right, John, let's talk about stage 2. And this morning I mentioned, if you were in the breast session, a study that Dr. Puzdai did in breast cancer showing that 23% of the deaths in breast cancer occur in patients who originally had stage 1 disease. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering, has there been a study looking at people who don't get adjuvant chemo in colon cancer and how much mortality that ends up being as a part of the mortality? You can tell me whether anybody's ever done that study with the SEER data. And if not, maybe somebody who wants to write a cool paper can do it. But I did ask ChatGPT and Dr. Van Cutsem, because we submitted an abstract to ESMO GI about this. And ChatGPT says of the 52,000 people who die of colon cancer every year, about 10% are stage 2 who didn't get adjuvant chemo. Mm-hmm. So my question is, why would you not want to do a cell-free DNA assay in a patient who maybe you're not going to treat? Okay, yeah, you don't have data to show that if you treat, it's going to lower it, but if they have a 90% chance of recurrence, you would treat them. So
Well, first of all, a comment on AI. AI seeks to please.
Okay.
Right? So,
you disagree with AI's estimate?
Well, no, I don't disagree with the estimate. But when patients are going out and seeking advice from the AI, remember that chatbot is programmed to please that patient. So they may ask follow-up questions that tell that patient what they wanted to hear. So that's something to be mindful of. But, you know, the challenge we've got in any kind of real-world database is, what is the patient who would not get chemo that has an indication for it? It's typically a patient who has such significant comorbidities or other health challenges that we're uncomfortable giving that, maybe their advanced age.
Or if they have stage 2 and no high-risk factors,
yeah,
people aren't going to treat them.
Fair enough. And I think those are the patients where I really like to bring in an MRD test, because I would want to ensure that we are not under-treating a patient.
Well, the problem, I mean, I know it's only, 5 or 10% chance mm-hmm. it's going to be positive, but the denominator, particularly with all the screening, right, Momtel, you have so many people now that you're not actually treating. I mean, we do tests all the time where we get, you know, we're about to talk about lung cancer. We're looking for things that occur in 1% of people. Mm-hmm. Why would we not want to do an assay where 5% chance that they're going to be positive, kind of like PSA? Anyhow, more to be discussed, but we're going to take a break now, and thank you so much.
Thank you.